Dr. David Leaf is the New South Wales and National Convener of Doctors for Assisted Dying Choice in Australia. He is also a primary care physician and a visiting medical officer at several nursing homes in North Sydney, actively engaged in palliative care medicine. Ed Blakely is a former Washington insider, an internationally recognised leader in urban development and planning, advisor and author.
Dr. Leaf, just give me a quick summary of your career in the medical profession. Where'd you go to school? What'd you do? And what are you doing now?
Well, we don't call it a school in Australia. We call it a university. I went to the University of Newcastle Medical School just north of Sydney. And I was in the fourth year of intake in that university as it was quite new. And it was the second problem-based learning medical school in the world after one in Canada at McMaster. So instead of it being us being spoon-fed information, then being expected to feed it back, we were encouraged to go and source our own information and learn how to solve problems and gaps in our knowledge as they came up, which has served me well over the years. So I graduated in the end of 1990 and was an intern in 1991. So this year I've been a doctor 31 years. And
so what did you intern in?
Well, in Australia, like the rest of the Commonwealth, we don't intern in a particular area. In fact, by law, we have to intern in every area. So you have to be signed off that you've done 3-month terms in general medicine, general surgery, and emergency medicine, and then two others after that. So unlike the US, where you intern in, say, pediatrics, I had a general, like everyone else, by law, a general education. And after that, did another year of generalism and then another one as well. So I was 3 years rotating around different terms in hospitals in Newcastle as we call them a resident. You'd call them a junior resident, I think, before I became what is called a registrar, which you call a resident. And I did a 2-year registrarship in internal medicine before I decided to become a primary care doctor. In Australia, that meant that I had to do a 3-year specialist training program.
I know you do a lot of work in rural areas. Yeah. You have some military background. Tell me about that.
So after the fellowship in general practice, which is a 3-year degree, I did another year's extra qualification because I was working in the country in rural New South Wales. And I got another residency board certification, whatever you call it. We call them fellowships in rural medicine, which means that you have to do extra training in emergency medicine, obstetrics, retrieval, that kind of thing. And so after that, I worked for another 8 years in rural New South Wales. I got to the point in about 1998 where I was wanting another challenge and joined the Army Reserve here for 2 years and would go out into the bush, learned how to be a soldier, learned how to use firearms and use my medicine in a military remote context, which was interesting. But just down the road from where my practice was a tactical fighter base for the Royal Australian Air Force. And one thing led to another, and I transferred over to the Air Force in 1999. And within 1 year, I'd done 3 interstate courses and then was deployed to East Timor, which was the deployment called INTERFET, where the Australian and international forces supported the very new country of East Timor after it developed in and was able to achieve independence after a referendum. That was my first experience in the deployed environment. Dili, the capital of East Timor at the time, I got there in January 2000, 3 months after it had been liberated was still a smoking wreck. There was one building that was untouched in the entire city of about 100,000 people, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that was the Portuguese governor's residence. Every other standing structure was destroyed and frequently still smoking. So my job was to coordinate and perform aeromedical evacuations within the islands of East Timor for the UN and Royal Australian Air Force teams, and then also take them back to Australia if people were unwell. I did that again twice in 2001 and 2004. And in 2002, I did a different deployment to a country called Bougainville, which is off the northeast coast of Australia, which is another emerging country looking for independence, which it still is, incidentally. But in 2004, during my deployment, which was when I left rural general practice, and I had the idea that I was going to join the Air Force full time as a doctor, I went over there supposedly for a 1 month relief term. That became 4 months. I stayed there for 4 months. And right at the end of it, I was in a helicopter that crashed in the mountains. And I was slightly injured, but two of my crew were very seriously injured. And I had to treat them and retrieve them. And the events around that eventually persuaded me that perhaps that kind of lifestyle wasn't for me. So in 2005, I came back and decided to do a residency in emergency medicine. So I was rotating around emergency departments and intensive care units for the next 12 years in Sydney.
Interesting. And that kind of background, particularly military and emergencies, brings a lot of death that you see. And that's the topic that we're going to talk about now. And how people go out, the trauma of dying and the trauma of watching dying and being a friend or a colleague of someone dying is pretty difficult. All of us, at least my age, have experienced it. And our topic today is, some people call it the right to die, some people call it voluntary or assisted suicide. What are we talking about in terms of the general discussion about people leaving the world on their own terms? What's the vocabulary?
Okay. So what I'd like to talk about is what we're trying to achieve in all Australian states, and the US has achieved in 11 states so far, is called voluntary assisted dying. So that is exclusively for people who are facing imminent death. And the definition of that slightly varies between different jurisdictions around the world. But generally, it relates to people in the last 6 or 12 months of life because of some terrible terminal illness. Sometimes it's cancer, most often. Sometimes it's a neurodegenerative disease like motor neuron disease, severe multiple sclerosis, where people's suffering to them is intolerable. And so for them, death is the better of two options, because staying alive results in them experiencing symptoms. And I'll talk about what those symptoms can be, because it's not what you think. Results in those people experiencing symptoms which are intolerable and cannot be relieved by even the very best palliative care or medical treatments. And so the symptoms we talk about are, and most people, when they think of assisted dying and the right to die, think of pain, people whose pain is intolerable, mm-hmm. and unrelievable by medical science. It's on the list, but it's actually surprisingly not at the top of the list.
Really?
Yeah. It's probably about number 3 or 4 if you survey dying patients or people who've chosen to avail themselves of assisted dying in legislations where it's legal. Yes, top of the list is what they call an existential crisis. So these people and their families know that they are dying. They are on a one-way street, and there is nothing that anyone can do to prevent that. And they are heading towards a death, which often they've had, don't forget, they've had experiences of other people around them dying. They've seen friends and family and maybe other people at the clinics that they visit who die in various states of distress, and they don't want to go there.
So it's a conscious decision.
Correct.
To go someplace, not to stop being something, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. What these people will tell you is that they want to have some element of control. They are being controlled by a disease or diseases that are depriving them of the life they want or wanted. Mm-hmm. And they want to regain some aspect of control in this journey. And it's interesting, an interesting stat that demonstrates this is that about, this is from Oregon, and this has been the case since 1997, 24 years ago to date, where it was first legalized. And it still remained remarkably constant, and internationally as well, that 30% of people who get authorized to have medicine in the house, which will result in their death, will never use it. And it's because they leave it on the shelf as a, in case of emergency, break glass. It's the thing that they will use if they truly feel that things have gotten out of hand. And often they die from other things, intercurrent illness or the progression of the disease. But they die, and they will tell you that they feel comfortable that it's just there. So they have some degree of control over this monster that's taken over their body.
Now, these are people who get these medicines legally or illegally, but have them to control whatever it's going to hurt, right?
Right. Well, so no, I don't know about illegally. I'm sure
it's legally.
That this is people who've gone through the process within their jurisdiction.
Okay.
They've been authorized to have the medicine. Yeah.
All right. So now there are different kinds of illness. There's mental illness, unwellness, and physical unwellness. And most of the things I hear about relates to physical unwellness. But is mental covered under this?
Not often. In some of the European jurisdictions, Holland and Belgium and Luxembourg, there is certainly precedent where people have gone through the process and the intolerable suffering relates to severe intractable depression or schizophrenia or other mental illnesses where the classic medical authorities that they're being involved with agree that there is nothing that can be done for this person.
Okay.
Medicine is like that. It's a spectrum. You can help a lot of people. There are some people you can't help.
So let's get back to the definitions. You gave me what is the correct definition here, and that's the definition we should use. Is that right?
Yeah.
Because shortcuts like suicide are not definitions of what you're talking about.
Yeah, let's talk about this because it's a word that my medical colleagues sometimes use intentionally or even unintentionally, and it's a word that the opponents to assisted dying seek to use to vilify what we're doing. And I'd like to read you a lovely definition of the difference between suicide and assisted dying. And this is from Go Gentle Australia. The distinction between suicide and a rational decision to end suffering was clearly understood by New York's chief medical examiner, Charles Hirsch, when investigating the deaths of office workers who jumped from the Twin Towers in 9/11. Faced with a terrible choice of a slow, agonizing death by fire or a quick death by jumping out of the window. Many chose to jump. Seeing this as a rational choice to avoid needless suffering, Hirsch refused to classify their deaths as suicides. These are the people who jumped out of buildings.
Yes, I was there.
Right, okay. Assisted dying is not a choice between life and death. It is the choice of a terminally ill person about the manner and timing of their death, which is imminent and inevitable. So these people are already on a one-way street, as I said. It's not suicide. And
it's not suicide.
Certainly in some of the more recent legislations in Australia, that definition has been more clearly defined.
So now that we have the definition, it is clear that there are a number of ways this can be done. So would you walk me through, are there special doctors that do this? Can any doctor do it? What are the protocols here with respect to assisting a person and taking that last step?
Internationally, the drugs used are slightly vary depending on the jurisdiction. And I have a counterpart in the United States who came to Australia to help us achieve legislative change in Western Australia. And he and I talked about the drugs and the modalities that were used, and it's slightly different to what is ultimately now being used in Australia. Essentially, if you think of it as two separate methods, depending on the patient's preference and their capacity. So you can take medication orally. It's usually a liquid mixture of a preparation or a cocktail of drugs, or it's an injection through an intravenous cannula of another cocktail of drugs. The reason that there's the difference, Ed, is that some patients get to a stage where they physically can't swallow.
Yeah.
Or they can't raise a cup to their lips.
Yeah.
And they need assistance. Some people's diseases are such that their stomachs can't absorb medications. And last week saw the first voluntary assisted dying death in Western Australia after that law implemented it on 1 July this year, 2021. And that patient required an injection by preference because they had gastrointestinal problems, and it worked very well and smoothly. So it can be orally, or it can be what they call MAID, medical aid in dying, which is also used in Canada very extensively, I'm aware, through an intravenous medication. All that happens is the patient goes to sleep.
All right. But let's say a patient was in an accident and they've been in a coma for 30 days and their family said, let's pull the plug. Is that within the parameters of this kind of approach?
No, see, that's not actually assisted dying. That's letting die. And there's a big difference. And it relates to consent, medical futility. And when I was working in intensive care, it used to happen all the time. People with various illnesses, usually a central nervous system insult, where they went from being a relatively normal, well-functioning person to having essentially brain death or an illness where the consensus of the medical treating teams was that the person was extremely unlikely to make any further progress, and that they were not retrievable, and that indeed keeping them on a ventilator was cruel. So in those people, and I've done it myself many times after the decision, the family gets to say goodbye. And usually what happens is actually the endotracheal tube is removed and the patient's breathing support stops and they stop breathing. So that's very different to a conversation that happens with a doctor and the patient, and often the family, in the doctor's office or their home, in the cold light of day when there's no, you know, super urgency. It's not it's not an emergency situation.
All right, so we covered what this is. Who's doing it? Where can you do this?
Okay, so around the world currently, as of today, 30th of July, 2021, there's 24 jurisdictions in the world, and the lists are available online. You've got 11 states in the US where it is legal and working, everything from Maine to California and a lot in between. In Australia, we've got two states actually doing it at the moment, and another two where it's legal and there's an implementation phase where doctors are being trained up. In answer to a question you asked a little bit before, any doctor can do it. It's really where you get trained to comply with the assessment and paperwork process, ensuring that the state's processes are adhered to. And in many states, you don't have to be a specialist in that particular area. You just have to have familiarity with the patient and their medical situation.
All right. So it sounds like this is going to become general, because when California and Maine adopt something in the United States, everybody else in the middle crumbles to it, because if they don't, people go to those other jurisdictions and get it done either way. So it's like abortion. If you don't have an abortion in Alabama, they just go to Texas.
Right.
But is there any national legislation here that prevents the actions of a state?
There is not. In Australia, the responsibility for health is a state matter. There is some blurring also, because two Australian states are actually what they call territories, which are actually administered by Canberra, the federal government. That is the ACT, Australian Capital Territory, and the Northern Territory. And the current Conservative government of Australia will not allow those two jurisdictions to introduce assisted dying laws. In fact, the Northern Territory was the first state in the world, apart from Switzerland, where it's been active in since 1940, doing assisted dying.
So it's like Washington, D.C. You can do it everywhere, but you can't do it in D.C., right?
Well, you can now in D.C.
I know, but in the old days, D.C. was captive of the federal law.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, not being a state.
So,
and Puerto Rico as well.
1995 had assisted dying legislation. Three patients availed themselves of that before the then new Conservative government flexed their muscle and overrode them. And they haven't been able to reverse that. And that looks like it's coming.
And I can see from the documents you've provided me, Go Gentle Australia, that this is a movement and it's really catching fire.
Yep.
Are all the states in Australia considering this now?
Yes. So as of today, there's two remaining states that haven't legislated yet, Queensland and New South Wales. Queensland goes to the vote in 6 weeks' time, and New South Wales sometime later this year.
I say, with being locked up in COVID, we hope it's earlier.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a little bit later than earlier. But yeah. Look, as you say, Ed, there's a massive mood for change. The polls of our society are the same pretty much internationally. But in Australia, it's between 80 and 85% support for
us. Oh, boy, that's better than homosexuality.
It's better than marriage equality, yes.
Yeah,
so
marriage equality, yes.
The final marriage equality vote in Australia was 62% or thereabouts, which became legal a few years ago. So this has much, much, much more popular support. And I think it's because most people, most adults have had some sort of contact with dying patients in one form or another, grandma or their spouse or whatever. And they've seen how deaths can occur. And look, it's not for everyone. Palliative care often does a fantastic job, And their treating doctors do a great job, and sometimes people just want to go through that process. But there's a small number of people where assisted dying is really what they want, and they are aware of where it's going to go. They don't want various forms of medical intervention, such as chemotherapy, and they want to nominate a time and date of their choosing where they can pass away.
All right. Look, I have another question. There are industries that are always involved in things. And as a lawyer, I'm aware of this. The insurance industry.
Yeah.
If I elect this procedure, do I still get my insurance payout? Because the insurance policies generally say suicide, taking your own life, is excluded as a form of dying. Have you had any pushback from the insurance industry, or are they on side with this?
Not at all. And as far as I'm aware, in Victoria, where they've been active for 2 years, there haven't been any problems with it. I'm happy to go and research that properly. But bear in mind that the thing that's killed them isn't suicide, and it's not recorded as such on their death certificate.
That makes a big difference.
It's the actual disease that they died from. And that's not playing with words, it's reality.
Well, in COVID situation, people go down very fast.
Yeah.
And they might elect to do this in their last literal breath, but they are going down the slide anyway. If a person's nominated this while they're that close to death, the physician, I guess that's more kind of what I said earlier, pulling the plug, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it's not really the same. And people suffering a acute illness aren't really going to qualify for this. There's even if the paperwork and process is expedited, the fastest you can really do it in is, you know, a week, maybe 2 weeks. And with COVID, it's just not going to cut it.
It's too fast. All right, go through the strictures that are applied in utilizing assisted dying.
Okay, so you want to know the process. So,
yes.
So basically, a patient will approach their doctor, often their general practitioner, or their oncologist, for example. And
or a friend, I would think, or a partner. They may not be able to leave the hospital or home.
Yeah, it might be that friend or next of kin that approaches the doctor, but it must come from the patient.
Yes, understood.
They must be a
actively involved,
consenting adult with what we call full capacity, and they have the desire to avail themselves of the process. They are informed fully of all their options, not just assisted dying, palliative care options, active medical treatment options. That discussion can be once or many times. They can opt out at any time. They apply for assisted dying. The what's called the coordinating doctor, doctor number one, let's call them, say me, fills in the forms and records the conversations. That doctor then has to engage what is called a consulting doctor, doctor number two. And they have to be a real doctor, Ed, not like Dr. Blakely. They have to be a medical doctor. And that doctor will then assess the patient and the patient's medical records and write back that they concur or agree with the assessment, that all the relevant steps have been adhered to, the patient is competent, and we can talk about that in a sec, and they agree. The coordinating doctor then applies to the licensing board with all the relevant information. The licensing board then deliberates and authorizes or does not authorize the release of.
And who's the board? Where's the board from?
So they're a state licensing board. In Victoria, for example, it's part of the Victorian Health Department.
So there's a board like there is for surgery and things like this. Is it a certified board, like a practice board, or what kind of a board is it?
It's called a board, but not in the way you're thinking. Let's call it a committee.
A committee.
Whose job is specifically designed to assess the process for these patients.
In each case?
In every single case, yep. And they frequently are comprised of lawyers, doctors, and other health bureaucrats.
Okay.
And their job is to make sure that the legislation has been adhered to, the correct medical decisions appear to have been made by the documents supplied, and then they write back to the coordinating doctor and give a green light to the release of the medications required. Now, at that point, there's absolutely no compulsion for that patient to go ahead. And as I said, about 30% of people don't. But if they do, in Victoria, what happens, which is an unusual state internationally, the health department's pharmacy department will actually drive to the patient's home, wherever that is in the state. And it's a big state, and that can be sometimes hours out of the capital city, Melbourne. And they will deposit the medications in a locked box with a key, and the patient and their doctor is informed on how to do it. And there's bottle one, bottle two, bottle three, they have to be signed for. And after they're used, they have to be accounted for in the same way as other accountable drugs, such as morphine. And then once the patient has used the medications and passed away, the process is then reported back to that board or committee to make sure that the process was adhered to again, and the doctor can issue a death certificate as well.
Oh, okay. It's a very, very thorough purpose, but let's go back through it. First, a person has to be dying, one-way street. There's no other choice.
Well, it's interesting. In the New South Wales legislation that's coming, it actually talks about is suffering unbearably, and it actually doesn't use the word terminal. So that gives us some flexibility as to the definition, and it will be mainly used for terminal patients, but it can be things such as people with severe multiple sclerosis or severe motor neuron disease, where that death could take a long time.
Yeah, but it's not suicide, like a person jumping out of a window because a gorilla is chasing them.
Correct.
Or they don't feel good that day. It is an active act, which is administered by a third person, not their spouse, not their nurse, but an attending physician who's qualified to do so, who is supervised in that by another physician, and then a board's involved. So there's a lot of protocol here, a high quality of care, and decision is ultimately with the individual, not the system.
Correct. It's driven by the patient. It's something that's done in the cold light of day. It's not done in the middle of the night as something we hadn't even thought about 12 hours ago. It takes days to deliberate on and think about, and are you sure? The doctor is required to ensure that there's no suspicion that the patient is being coerced. And this is one of the arguments brought up internationally, that it'll make mercenary relatives want to knock off grandma because they want some money. There's no evidence that this happens internationally. And if
but also a lot better ways to knock off grandma.
Well, that's my point. If you wanted to knock off grandma, you would do it in the cold, in the dark of night, rather than through an
open process.
Reliable process supervised by the state. Yeah.
And furthermore, there's another physician there who's unknown to either party, who might be known, but they're another physician. There's a quality of oversight.
Yes, that's right. And that physician cannot be Usually it cannot be a member of that doctor's original practice. There's an arm's length. The other doctor may or may not have met that other patient before.
Well, I've learned a lot here. Are there a few things that I haven't learned that you think would be important to our audience?
Yes, indeed. Firstly, that this is coming. So as you alluded to earlier, in Australia, we've been lobbying for it for many years. We'd had lots of failed bills where it didn't get up. And since 2017, where in Victoria, the legislation was finally passed that year, the New South Wales attempt was defeated by one vote. Mm-hmm. And since then, Western Australia got across the line about 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. This year, 2021, we've had two states, Tasmania and South Australia, and we may well have four states all in one year. So there's a momentum and an impetus for it to occur. And that really reflects what society wants. We're seeing this around the world. And during that time, in the last 12 months, several other notable jurisdictions have legalized it. In our part of the world, New Zealand, legislated last year, 2020. And this year, Spain has legalized assisted dying. I believe last year, Germany as well. So England is still wrestling with it. But I think as time goes by, it's inevitable it's going to come. And that's really because people want it, and it's medically right. If I'm sitting there with a patient, I want to offer them the full suite of options, one of which may be this. And I will never, it's voluntary. I will never, like any other decision, I will never emphasize it one way or the other. It's for the patient to make that decision.
Yes. In our lifetime recently, three issues have been touchstones. The first being abortion, you know, does a person live? The second is marriage equality.
Right.
Who can you marry? And this is the third one. They're on a continuum for me, that how you come into the world and gain control of your life, who you decide to live with and not live with, and then how you decide to go out. So all these things are matters of informed consent, which means it's important for shows like this to get out the right information so people can make quality decisions. And I want to thank you in helping me with this. We'll be running a show, and hopefully there'll be more people who listen to this, understand this debate, and act what they should do now is an informed way with their own representatives in Congress or representatives in their state legislatures, so that we get this right.
I like to think of it as internal democracy. You get to choose what happens to you, your body, and yourself. And
yeah, but there are some places where I would say that's not right. You can't say that about a vaccine where if you don't take it, you can do harm to me. If you don't get vaccinated, it's not the harm that you do to yourself, but to me, my grandchildren, and others. So your vaccination is a right that I have to guard my family against your careless activity like driving your car drunk.
Yeah, I couldn't agree. And you can extrapolate that to smoking in public.
That's right.
Smoking in restaurants, exposing me to passive smoking, driving while drunk, even
or without a seatbelt,
driving on the correct side of the road.
Yeah,
right? You know, it's not your right to drive on whichever side of the road you want,
or to drive through the stop sign.
Exactly. Yeah.
So here's a go sign. Thank you, David, very much. And when we get out of this, I'll be glad to see you again in person.
I'll make sure you do. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. A good story.
Subscribe wherever you find Pacific Conversations as a podcast to make sure you don't miss out on our next conversation. For more, check out the website edtalks.com.au. And for weekly US news and current affairs, there's Ed and I's other podcast, US of Ed, wherever good podcasts are found.